You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Yes or no? Did you ever take banned substances to enhance your cycling performance?
Yes.
I had no prior knowledge of the planned assault on Nancy Kerrigan.
I am deeply sorry for my irresponsible and selfish behavior I engaged in.
Welcome to Oops the Podcast. Oh, it sounds good. We are physically together again. The band is back together.
Cheers to that, dude.
For the first time in months.
Unbelievable.
We have not seen each other or been in physical proximity for some 10 odd weeks, probably more. And we are now back in our home studio, home base, in our comfortable purple chairs, set off by our colorful, wonderful backdrop. We've got Chris and Julio both wearing lovely pastel colored t-shirts. The two of them seem to coordinate outfits before we meet. It makes me feel left out and angry. Julio, how are you?
Dude, good to fucking see you, man.
It's great to see you.
This is fantastic.
It is. Chris, how are you?
I'm great, but you put on that beautiful floral shirt just to get in with us.
I don't own shirts that come from a Crayola pack. I don't own a watercolor outfit. So
you, dude, this shirt looks like you inherited it.
From my dead grandmother. Damn it. I love this shirt.
It's a good shirt, dude. It's timeless.
I gotta tell you, that was probably the single biggest joy for me, was returning to the apartment and having access to my wardrobe again.
Yeah, dude, I know.
I have worn the same 3 pairs of pants for 100 days.
That's crazy.
I have worn, you know, the same shirts, the same fucking 4 t-shirts, the same 3 pairs of pants for so many days, and it just feels so boring.
Yeah, it does.
And there's something now, having access to my wardrobe again, it feels as if someone went shopping for me and I'm every day just putting on brand new clothes.
Right.
No, which is the best feeling.
It is a nice surprise. I will say this though, on the other side of that, I feel like I definitely appreciated the fact that I suddenly realized I don't need all my shit.
Yeah.
Right? What?
I'm still laughing about your comment about how I looked like I inherited this shirt. That's so funny. It took my breath away. I was like, oh, where do I go from here? You know, it was such a good insult.
Well, so, dude, with thank you. I appreciate that. It's funny. We're like now politely. You're like, that was a nice insult.
I was like, all right, now I'm supposed to roast him back, but I don't even know who I am anymore. Do I have a dick?
Dude, already, baby. 30 seconds out of the gate.
Yeah.
Ripping.
That was great.
But I feel like there's this illusion of choice with wardrobe when it comes to wardrobe. Like, I know you to feel comfortable wearing certain things more than other things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sometimes I'll be like, I'll see a t-shirt that I see you wear that I'm familiar with.
Yes.
Because you like certain t-shirts. Like, and I feel like that's how it works with clothes. Like, certain shit just fits you well, mm-hmm. and you're down to wear it. So, like, in a situation like this, more broadly, this has reminded me that I shouldn't be so worried about massive change or about things kind of going to shit, because things have gone to shit.
Yes.
And we're in New York City, and things have really gone to shit. And although it fucking sucks, like, we're living our life still, you know?
True. Having said that, it is very apparent to me that the clothes that I brought with me to Maine were not my A team.
Ah, dude.
I did not bring my starting rotation.
Same.
Hilarious. I did not bring my best bullpen.
Totally.
And that's devastating, by the way. Yeah. When you are forced to wear your J.R. Smith 40 times in 100 days. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Totally.
But then again, nobody's really seeing you. So it just ends up being that you and your girlfriend are a lot less attracted to each other.
Well, dude, you're also lucky to have J.R. Smith coming off the bench.
That's true.
Right?
By the way, speaking of J.R. Smith, and this is a great transition into, obviously, we're going to tackle some of the serious stuff that's happening. We were so joyous to see each other, but make no mistake, we're very in tune with the civil unrest and the clamor and the adversity that is facing the country right now. But let's start with J.R. Smith. I'm sure maybe you saw the clip.
I did.
Of him just beating the hell out of some idiot who broke his window. It reminds me of that Joe Budden clip where those like three internet trolls like went after Joe Budden and he just chased them down.
Yeah,
like
it was in his car, right?
GTA.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Came up to their window and was like, "You fucked the wrong person. If I see you again, I'll kill you." And they were like, "We know, you know, we know you'll kill us." But J.R. Smith, famous obviously for forgetting that the score was tied in NBA Finals Game 1, dribbling out after getting an offensive rebound that could have won the game against the Warriors upon LeBron James' best, I think, best playoff performance ever, 51-8-8 or something. The game goes to overtime, they lose, and get swept in the series, ending LeBron's second tenure in Cleveland. J.R. Smith, kind of a laughingstock of so many people as a result of that. He is seen here in this clip beating up a guy who broke his window. And then immediately he did have the foresight to post an explanation himself.
That was really smart.
Of what was going on. He said, "Look, this is the broad daylight. It's in a suburban neighborhood. This guy came, didn't know what he was doing, and he broke my window. So I beat him up." And everyone was universally like, was like,
deserve that,
"Good for you, J.R. Smith.
Totally.
We're behind you."
Absolutely.
So very funny.
Yeah, that was great. And, you know, I mean, J.R. Smith, crazy career for sure.
Yeah. But, dude, there's something so funny about watching a guy who's 6'6".
I know.
Wearing size 17 basketball sneakers try to kick somebody.
I know.
Those are not kicking shoes. Those are flippers. You can't, kicking somebody in basketball shoes does not have the same effect as if you kick somebody in Pumas. Do you know what I mean? Like something that's close to being kind of like a kickboxing, you know, shoe.
A basketball shoe is more of a stomping shoe.
It makes a thump.
Totally.
Yeah, you can't get much impact. It's those tongues are so cushioned.
Right, right.
Second worst shoe only to maybe some skateboarding shoes, I would say. Skateboarding shoe, you kick somebody, it's like hitting them with a pillow.
Right, right. That's really funny.
So, yeah, hysterical there. Any thoughts on JR?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was happy to see him play well when they got that championship. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, I just went completely. I just felt bad that we were fucking shitting on him. But, I mean, he is an interesting figure. But, dude, yeah, it was really funny that he just, like, beat the shit out of that guy, especially because it's so interesting to see a guy who you're used to seeing amongst people who are his size, because he's like short on the court compared to everybody.
He's so, a shooting guard. Yeah.
Yeah. To see him towering over this little guy.
Yeah.
It's definitely smart that he got ahead of that, because it looked like, you know, an unfair fight.
Right.
But the guy deserved it.
J.R. Smith is a member of my golf course.
Really?
And we played in the club championship qualifier last year.
No way.
And there were only about 12 or 13 guys vying for the 8 spots in the club championship. And these were all the top dogs of the club. So it's everybody that's got a handicap below 7. So solid, very solid
good
golfers.
Good players, yeah.
It was 97 degrees.
Oh my God.
And I was in the group, the 3 ball, ahead of J.R. Smith. I'm telling you right now, I've never seen something so funny as watching J.R. Smith and two chubby, short, white dudes sweating profusely and walking up the fairway. J.R. Smith looked like a glorious gazelle. The most athletic, cleanly dressed guy, accustomed to performing in heat. The two guys behind him could not have been a starker contrast.
That's so
of just them being, you know, practically collapsing under the heat as JR, 6 foot six, JR Smith. But still, JR didn't qualify. I think he shot like 88 or something.
Did you?
I did.
Wow.
Yeah, I shot 84. I held on.
And so how did it go? Did you win the tournament?
Then I qualified for the club championship, which was match play, and you played like two or three matches.
Oh, interesting.
And I lost because I was
it round robin or it's like a single elimination?
It's single elimination. Oh. I played in the quarterfinals against the two seed who ended up winning the whole thing.
He just like shoot a crazy
shot. 70 to me. I shot 81 or something. I mean, I lost every hole. I lost on like the 14th hole.
Wow.
It was embarrassing.
But whatever, you qualified. That's exciting.
It was cool.
That's really fun.
But let's pivot. Let's dive into the stuff that matters.
Yeah, I mean, I walked over here today from the East Village.
We are in New York City, currently recording on Monday.
Correct.
So, you know, the morning after a night of, June 1st.
Right.
A second night in a row of protests that in many places turned into riots.
Looting.
Mm-hmm. Fires.
Right.
It's a tense moment.
It's scary. You know what I mean? It's just, it's unsettling because, you know, for a variety of reasons, like broadly it's scary because it's the city you live in, you're watching it kind of just get destroyed. And I completely understand the protests and the frustration and I get it all. And I agree. And I feel that way too. But it's crazy to see like stores that you're used to walking by just with gigantic holes or no glass in the storefront.
Yeah.
And like all over the city too. Like on the walk here, like I saw nail salons and then like designer clothing stores and just like liquor stores everywhere. And it's crazy.
Yeah. It speaks to a truth which you don't see very often, which is that New York City, despite its tens, if not hundreds of thousands of police officers, simply does not have the means to quell uprisings
right.
if enough people are involved.
The people are the power.
They cannot handle it. There totally. Is not a system in place to fully quiet angry mobs.
To thwart
the
protesters.
And so, you know, that reality basically means that if shit really hit the fan, it's every man for himself.
Right.
You're on your own.
Totally.
There are so many angles to this. Obviously, you know, our stance is, you know, as far as the George Floyd murder, which is what it was, is a horrific new chapter in a far too long book already of police brutality and mistreatment, certainly of people of color. It's just another sad, sick moment. You compare it to things like gun violence and you know, you wonder like, what is there to be done? What can we do? Why does this shit keep happening? I think that it came at an incredibly interesting moment. We've never faced a global pandemic that has caused people to be so pent up in their emotions,
totally.
In their feelings of helplessness already. You know, we can't, there's nothing people can do. People have been inside for 2 months. And so it was sort of a perfect storm, to I think create what looks to be the biggest reaction so far that I can remember
in my lifetime.
Yeah, because I don't really remember the LA riots.
Right,
I don't remember.
That's where my brain just went to, like Watts and.
Yeah, I don't remember, you know, the stuff, the burnings and all of that. So for me, this is as far as the fact that it spread to so many different cities beyond Minneapolis, where it, you know, what happened, is just incredible. It has affected so many people and, you know, I struggle to find the words. Yeah, and right. Part of that is that I'm nervous to speak on this issue.
Right.
I'm nervous to post on this issue.
Right.
On social media.
Same.
There is a real, what to me feels like a tightrope walk of being sensitive, being insensitive,
being insincere.
Insincere, looking like you are, in a way, capitalizing on a moment for, or just, yeah, insincere is really the threat to me.
Yeah.
Weigh in. I don't know.
You're saying this all really well, and I feel like you're summing it up and speaking for both of us for sure. I feel like in the past, like as far as posting about this kind of stuff, it's something that I've sort of shied away from just for, because being divisive for whatever reason. And I think if I break it down, it just comes down to like, and I feel bad and guilty saying this, but like inconvenient. It's more convenient to not do it,
mm-hmm.
which is fucked up to even say aloud. Like I feel, right. I feel terrible saying that, but it's unique right now. And I think that this is good and healthy that people are really pressuring everybody to post about this stuff.
Yeah.
And, my girlfriend mentioned it to me. She's like, are you going to post something? And I hadn't even really thought about it just because I've always sort of been like, I'm going to separate that. Like, that's not who I am to like
we're comedians.
Be political. Yeah.
I'm our like brands try to keep are it light to make people laugh.
Totally. And yeah. I even with my stand up, I tend to not like joke about that kind of stuff. And sometimes I feel bad about the fact that I don't.
Right.
That I keep it kind of personal or whatever. But I feel like now there's a pressure and they're like, if you're not saying anything, then you're fucking up, essentially.
You're with the other side, or right. you're contributing to the problem.
You're right. And I don't necessarily disagree with that.
I do.
Interesting.
I do. And with a caveat. Okay. I don't think that silence on social media means that you are voicing your support for the police.
Right, of course.
Or right. for continued, you know, fucking
right.
racial divide in this country.
Right, right.
My thought
agreed.
Is that I have two thoughts. The very cynical side of me says that a lot of these people, especially the white people, comedians, whoever, that are posting on social media, you know, their angry things, especially the, you know, if you're not standing up to this, you're a bad guy.
Right.
And you're not posting about this, you're doing wrong. Those people who just post a Black Lives Matter thing on their Instagram, then they kind of wipe their hands and they say, my job is done.
Right, right.
And it's not even, that speaks to the insincerity, which is like...
Agreed.
Which is like, did that make a fucking difference?
Right.
Did that 1 second screen grab post on Instagram, did that make a difference? Did you actually fucking move the needle?
Right, but I think it's like littering. You know what I mean? It's like if you throw one cup in the street, it doesn't matter. But if everybody throws a cup in the street, it's bad.
Well, here's my
other point, way around too.
Right?
Yeah.
My point is, okay, what could you do that would actually create meaningful change?
Right.
Right? Beyond just hoping that your social media post in this now sea of social media posts would kind of move people and galvanize a real change in this country. Mm. And for me, and this is kind of a left turn, something that I can do beyond donating to these causes or just throwing money at like whatever is, for me, it comes down to education.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always thought that the achievement gap, which is that, you know, white students in America versus Black students, Hispanic students, historically have tested far higher, and that this leads to greater professional opportunities, college placement, all of that along a racial divide. And that is bullshit.
Right.
And it shows up very prominently among fourth graders. And the fact that there is not equal opportunity for right, kids right. who are fucking 8 years old is bullshit.
Right.
And that makes me mad.
It's upsetting.
And years ago, I started doing some research because I was a tutor in New York City, and I was very good at teaching, and I liked teaching, and I had a little bit of free time on my hands during the day. I found this charter school in Brooklyn that was teaching, would take kids who had been either expelled or had been failed out of local public schools, and this was kind of like their last chance school. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to the principal, got in touch, figured out their mission, and I would go there twice a week, and I taught a geometry class because they were understaffed.
It's nice.
And that was something that I could do with a skill that I had, which was teaching, to directly impact, admittedly, a small number of kids, 15 kids in my class, twice a week, but hopefully make a change for those kids.
Right. 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 And that's all you can hope to do. You can't change the system on your own.
I thought and have always thought that education is the weapon against ignorance.
And also an inequality against, exactly. Really, truly.
Right. Yeah. So time and skill, to me, always felt like better ways to combat, inequality and
like doing your part.
Yeah. Than posting on social media.
Right.
Right. And I never posted on social media that I was going to the school to do this. And I'm only talking about it now to tell people that walking one night in a protest, yes, that is good. Showing your solidarity with this is good. Posting on social media is good. But putting your boots on the ground, getting your hands around the problem, offering physical skills and time mm-hmm. to help put out the flames is far more valuable, in my opinion.
Right. No, I agree.
And that is where I believe change can really happen, from a grassroots standpoint.
Right.
So if that means, going down to a homeless shelter or volunteering at a school or coming up with some way to actually really do things with the skill that you have that is needed, I would encourage our listeners to look into that,
right?
More than just donating 50, 100, 500 bucks to some cause.
Right. Dude, 100%. And I think that, I think it's so true what you're saying. Like, education is just it's like the most important thing to stop a lot of the problems or to curb them, a lot of the problems that we have. Right. From mainstream conspiracy theories to, racial inequality. Like, there's a lot of things that can be gained by, access to education and all this kind of stuff. And I think even further, I think you just made an amazing point, and that was all great stuff. But as far as education is concerned, I think just the amount of awareness that has been brought to this stuff over the past, decade or even in the past few years has been very valuable to me. Mm-hmm. Like, I about racism, and I just don't think that I knew about the scale with which these things were happening still.
Right.
Even in adulthood, and more so now, but just like, even as far as just like stuff with incarceration and people being put on death row, having like the weakest case ever, like the guy clearly didn't do it. And these people are on death row and being put to death. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And cell phones have been such an amazing tool for so many things and causes as far as like poverty, being able to just like wire people money from your cell phone has taken more people out of poverty than anything in the past, 20 years.
Yeah.
And the ability to film shit has really just opened our eyes to how often this kind of shit has been happening.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And you wonder, that probably has made police officers much more nervous to use tactics that before had gone unseen, right?
Totally.
Of more like brutal kind of shit. And look, don't get me wrong. I would think, in this day and age, if you want to become a police officer, I commend you, because I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
I think that has to be one of the most thankless, terrifying jobs.
Totally.
You have to we talked about this before. You got to pitch a perfect game.
Right.
You got to pitch a perfect game. Every fucking time you pull someone over for speeding, having a broken taillight, and you walk up to that car, that is a terrifying walk. You don't know if you're going to get shot. You don't know if you've pulled someone over who just robbed a bank. Regardless of skin color, any of that shit, every day you're on the line, you could get shot.
Right.
Especially if you work in certain places, right?
Totally.
So you're on edge. You're operating at a very high tension frequency. And you're reacting in split seconds to things that you perceive as threats. And look, it's one thing to kneel on a guy's neck for 9 minutes. We all know that's fucking murder. Fuck that guy.
Yeah.
But, you know, we also know that, as I said, I could see making a mistake as a police officer carries the weight of potentially setting the entire country off.
Right.
You know, totally. Lighting the country on fire.
Totally. And this was over. I mean, and I know this point has been beaten into our brains over the past few days, but the guy had a fake $20 bill.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that seems like...
Right. And this guy, by the way, that's not the mistake, right? That's not a mistake. But just knowing that as a police officer, like, you have the potential to light the country on fire with a decision you make. Like, I'm not doing that.
Totally. Totally.
Nope. I don't have the power to move people to protest in my work.
Yeah, right.
Do you know what I mean?
Right.
So there's luxury. There's comfort in the fact that not that many people give a shit about what I do.
Right. Right.
So it comes with a great deal of responsibility. And I don't know. It's tough to not talk in circles because there's just so many
things,
angles about this.
So that's another thing. I've been really feeling... there's some glimmers of hope in all this craziness where you see these pictures of, you know, I saw a picture of a protester and a cop pounding each other.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think it's important to remember that, you know, these things are so complicated. It's hard to just make a decision about what it is and what it isn't.
Right.
I think it's important to kind of like assess, try to learn good and bad things and try to make changes for the future, because there's a lot of peaceful protests. Obviously, there's a lot of cops who aren't bad. Obviously, there's a lot of the opposite, a lot of people looting and stealing and a lot of bad cops out there. You know what I mean? Like, things aren't simple.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And right. I think that that's an important thing to remember. And I hope that, you know, maybe like this is an encouraging moment because things are progressing. You know what I mean? I think part of the frustration of this whole thing is that every time something happens, everybody speaks out, everyone gets pissed, and then nothing happens. And that is very frustrating.
Yeah.
Like, how are you not going to change anything? I know with the gun stuff, it's a very similar thing. Like, it keeps happening. No one does anything. Keeps happening. No one does anything. So this, even though it feels extreme, it's there's something encouraging about it in general, about the idea of continuing to take it to the next step to try to enact change.
Right.
When it seems like it's been very difficult to do.
Right.
You know?
I think the education thing here works in a way too, though, you know, maybe police academies need to incorporate some kind of training element.
Right. They've been saying that
of the proper way to like hold on to somebody that you're
right.
I don't know. How do you, it seems like a no brainer of like,
right.
If a guy's running away from you, don't shoot him. Totally. If a guy is on, totally. You know, you don't leave your neck, like, stay away from the neck. What I don't know.
I know. The body cam thing is yeah. a good step, and
but
surveillance everywhere. I don't know.
The reason that I keep coming back to the education thing is that a lot of the statements that I've seen from prominent media personalities, my old boss Dave Portnoy put out a pretty good clip on his Instagram or Twitter or whatever of his reaction to all of this. And he said, you know, growing up, he never worried walking down the street that a cop was going to come up and kill him. He never feared the cops. In fact, he felt always as if the cops were protecting him. How do we get to a point where black people feel the same
right.
way about the police?
Right.
Because right now it's not that way.
Right.
And I thought that was a very compelling point. But his answer was he didn't know. He doesn't know, right? I'm saying education could be a start. Focusing on that, funding schools, trying to come up with community outreach programs, mentorships, big brothers, big brother programs, all of these things, get involved. You know, we've talked about this on the show, cross-cutting bonds, social capital.
Totally, totally.
We were talking about it from the standpoint of like interracial relationships, but there's no reason that white people tutoring black people or vice versa, or just like finding some way to have an impact on a young person, that is a great way to create trust and to create a sense that these black youth are not alone in this fight.
Right.
And I think that that is an inspiring and hopefully meaningful way to create change.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Totally. Well said.
We'll probably, you know, do some research and post some programs for people to kind of look into if they feel so inclined.
Guys, if you're thinking about starting a podcast, fill in the blanks here. If I were in a concert right now and I said, if you're thinking about starting a podcast, I'd then turn the microphone to all of you sitting in the stadium and you would all yell, Anchor, Anchor. And then you'd say, go to anchor.fm to download the software where you could host your very own podcast, see all the best analytics. You could see it in a way that was really user-friendly and nice and not too technical and industry jargony. It's a way that any person can look at it and be like, ooh, that's pretty. And also it's our podcast. And there's no minimum listenership required to advertise and monetize. So you can immediately have ads when you hit the ground running. It's really exciting, really spectacular. If you want to start your very own podcast, anchor.fm, download it now.
The social media side of it. Mm-hmm. One of the other reasons I haven't posted is that, you know, you get made fun of sometimes for white knighting.
Totally. And it's so hard to, I feel like no matter what I do, I'm really scared of like upsetting some of my close friends.
Yeah.
Who like, who this issue is much more, you know, real to them.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like we have tons of black friends. Like they have sort of helped me understand a lot of this stuff over the years, but I'm so scared of like seeming insensitive or white knighting or seeming like it's hard to like be supportive and not get shit for it. And beyond being made fun of, just about like people thinking, oh fuck, people are mad at you.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I don't want to piss off my black friends by posting something where they think it's just a credit grab, where I am just trying to get credit for having said something.
Right.
You know? And that's, it speaks to the insincerity part of it.
Totally.
Like none of what we do should be for the sake of having that feeling of I did my part.
Right. Totally. And it's uncomfortable. But that's good. It's good that it's uncomfortable because, you know, somebody would say, you know what else is uncomfortable? Having somebody kneel on your fucking neck till you die.
Right.
By saying that, am I white knighting right now? You know what I mean? Like it's such a hard thing to navigate around. And I feel unqualified to be talking about this.
Yes.
So broadly, I feel stressed out. Like I'm nervous. This conversation is making me nervous.
Right.
Because I want to make sure that I represent myself in a way that is fair and just and acceptable. And there's so much that goes into it that it's just like such a hard thing.
But even you saying this makes me nervous that people are going to be like, how dare you complain about feeling nervous about what to say?
And I'm not complaining.
We're not.
I'm just explaining how it is. Like the reason why I'm thinking about whatever I'm thinking.
Right.
I have nothing to complain about.
Yeah.
And I know that like what you said, what your boss said about not knowing what it feels like to feel like, you know, as a kid, like I felt the police were a friend.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
totally.
I feel guilty being able to say that.
You know, one thing for me that I've already felt and have kind of resolved, which I think is a good thing, is that, you know, I've told jokes that were based on race in my stand-up act.
I have too.
And you know, maybe they were a little lazy. They weren't like hateful, certainly. And I don't think frankly, enough people would have seen them that I would have been canceled had they been bad. They weren't bad. But from this, I made a decision. I was like, I am not doing race jokes anymore.
Right.
And I'm certainly not doing lazy race jokes.
Right.
You know, if I come up with something that's brilliant or a good story or whatever, or is like meaningful, yeah, maybe I'll do it, but I'm done with like jokes that are based off stereotypes,
same,
you know,
same
stuff like that. It's just
feels lazy, and it also feels like you're just unaware.
You're not helping. You're making shit worse.
And it's like, hello, where have you been the past 5 years or whatever?
Exactly.
Like, you're just gonna be like, oh, a fucking black guy, I can do it.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, how are you gonna go up there and do that?
No more. Right, you know how many?
Also, we can't do stand up right now.
I know.
What? This is so crazy. Like, there's no stand up anyway. So like,
I would love to see, you know, Dave Chappelle turn this into a funny thing.
Into gold.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, dude, I've sort of accepted that, like, I don't know that I can ever be on that level. And I think I'm fine with that. And that's totally fine. Like, it's for a variety of reasons. But I would really enjoy watching him say something really
profound.
And profound. Yeah.
He finds a way to philosophize these things while also making them funny. And that's what George Carlin did. That's what Richard Pryor did. They were speakers for their generation in their time. And boy, it would be really great to see Dave Chappelle drop in and offer just kind of off the top thoughts, just to let his mind unfold in front of an audience. I would pay so much money to be there for that.
Totally, dude. You know what? This made me think real quick. Are you friends with Drew Michael?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's a friend of mine too. I like him a lot. Mm-hmm. He did like a special that was like
no audience.
Kind of controversial.
Yeah.
There's no audience.
For HBO.
I thought it was great.
Mm-hmm.
I really enjoyed it. And I would love to, we should maybe try to talk to him about just how much his special now resonates.
Oh my God, I hadn't even thought about that.
And I saw him post on his Instagram something like, crazy, like something alluding to that fact. Like, he's aware of it, obviously. But he did his whole special without an audience. And I guess it's a different kind of special. It's not a conventional comedy special. Like, I heard comedians be like, it's not a special. It's like, okay, fine. Like, we don't need to put things in a box. Like, he did something different. Like, you don't have to like it. It's fine. Like, it seemed like it really fit his brand of material too. I recommend checking it out. But I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's funny to think that.
Reach out to him. Let's get him on the pod.
You know, because like, I could see Chappelle doing something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Where like, if he did do that, that would be incredible.
Yeah.
Like, Chappelle just did like a special with no audience the way that Drew did it.
Right.
He could do something incredible like with that, I think.
That's totally.
Like, I don't know.
All right. So I feel like we've come to a good place. Not a good place, but that's. I don't really have a whole lot more to say.
Same.
I don't think.
Agreed.
I'm not going to add much value by continuing to talk about this.
Agreed. I think we've sort of like the things that have come to mind. We sort of, before we started recording today, we agreed that about the things that were kind of coming to mind initially.
Mm-hmm.
And it's cool that we aligned on that.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like it's going to continue unfolding. We're not going to act like we're the experts about to talk on this situation. We're obviously not. But you know,
right. Yeah. Okay. So
let's pivot for a second.
With respect to everything that's going on, we are going to shift out of this topic now and leave it for another day. I'm sure we'll have more to say on it, but at the risk of sounding, sort of flippant, our podcast is meant to be uplifting, diverting. It is meant to provide hopefully a happy distraction from harsher times for a lot of people. We've gotten DMs from people saying exactly that. So we're going to return now probably to a series of topics that are absolutely meaningless, but hopefully will make you laugh in these harsh times.
And, you know, and I feel like we have a great group of friends and in this great community that we have of this Oops, the podcast and all this shit. So, you know, thank you guys for spending time with us during all this. It's been nice for us and I hope it's nice for you guys too.
Cool.
So quick question.
What do you got?
So in this like documentary era where documentaries are the thing, I would just like to say that I would like to see more investigative journalism and less recapping. Like, I just watched the Jeffrey Epstein docuseries and it was just a recap. It didn't teach me anything new. It was like so surface that it was just like really disappointing. And it was nice to hear from the victims and nice to give them faces and justice to a degree, as much as can be had. I know he's dead now. But it's really frustrating when I get really excited about this documentary, you get shoved down my throat, and then it just doesn't present any new information.
Well, here's what I would say. I think that it's recapping to you because it sounds like you read the story in real time pretty closely.
Not even. I honestly didn't. I wasn't okay. Like reading the Times every day.
Fair point.
But like just based on discussions, and maybe it's because I'm from New York and I know people who knew him and all this shit, but it was just nothing new to me. But I fair point.
Yeah. I guess my point is my favorite documentaries are about topics where I kind of missed it and I watched this thing and I'm like, I never knew that happened. Totally. I didn't know these people were involved. I can't believe it went that high.
Totally.
Okay. Fair. And so for that's me, fair. You know, yeah, I followed the Jeffrey Epstein closely story pretty closely, but I'm not really sure to what extent Bill Clinton was involved. I you know, you hear these rumors and whispers. He's ridden on the plane.
You won't learn about it in the doc either.
Okay. Well, then that just sounds like a bad documentary. Right. Yeah, right?
It really doesn't uncover anything new in those areas where we're like, was he there? Like,
right.
They kind of very briefly glaze over that.
There's such a conspiracy theory element to the Jeffrey Epstein case. And, totally. And a lot of conspiracy theorists feasted upon it to say that, you know, Hillary Clinton was involved, whatever, all this shit. And then he didn't kill himself. He was killed.
Right.
And if the documentary doesn't go into that, then it's far less
barely
salacious. And, you know, it doesn't sound that interesting.
It just includes that part that when they did, you know, the coroner report or whatever, they said that like it appeared like it was a bizarre suicide.
Yes.
Like that there was foul play or whatever, which sounds, again, not, it's yeah, not breaking news.
Sounds pretty surface level. Totally. The one thing that's interesting about Jeffrey Epstein though, before we move on from this, is that I've been getting emails from the president of Harvard as an alumnus. Mm-hmm. I get these emails and he explains what they're doing with the money that Jeffrey Epstein donated to Harvard.
Wow.
Because over the years, he's donated over $9 million, right?
Wow.
And they accepted it and they put it towards things. And then, of course, all of this came out. And since then, they've taken all of the money that he donated or just matched it or whatever, and they've put it towards women's causes.
That's good. That's good.
And victims of abuse and trafficking and organizations that fight that. So
that's great.
I think Harvard has tried to do well by this otherwise pretty poisonous influx of cash that they got.
Are you an involved alumni?
Not at all.
I'm impressed that you even read the email, though.
Well, that one was so interesting to me.
Right.
I mean, how do you deal with something like that?
So, do you go to reunions? Do you donate money? Like, are you involved? And
I went to my 5-year reunion, and it was one of the worst experiences of my life.
Because of the girlfriend stuff.
Correct.
Yeah, I remember that story.
Yeah.
Sorry, dude.
No, that's okay. But it made me not ever want to go back there.
Right.
But the sick part of it is that I would hate for any child of mine. I think it's safe to say any child of mine is not going to get into Harvard.
Why do you think that?
Because I just think that I have said too much stuff as a comedian and I'm too controversial of a person that any fucking Harvard admissions officer is going to Google the family name and be like, he said what? Fuck this kid. I don't care how good they are at the cello.
Well, this would be, you know, I think... The cello is always the example of the extracurricular
it is.
Instrument.
Nobody ever says flute or viola. It's always the cello.
Fucking cello. Well, dude, I think it'll be very Harvardian of you if you got ahead of this problem and gave your kid maybe your wife's name.
Yeah, or just changed our names completely.
Completely change your
but
names.
But, dude, you know... You do start to think about this sort of thing now where you start to say, okay, well, should I be donating money, even in a small amount, to Harvard so that they can look back 15 years from now and be like, oh, yeah, he's been donating money every year for 15, 20 years. You know, you start to think about that this far in advance.
No, totally. And I think that there is some sort of strong argument about donating to universities. I mean, the private universities in America... You know, it's hard to argue that there's a country that has better private universities. Obviously, there's scattered good universities, but the volume of good universal, good institutions in America is unlike anything else.
Correct.
And there's value there.
Yeah.
But if someone's like, do you want to donate money? I would have to have a lot of money to be donating to my school.
That would be one of the lowest causes you would donate money to.
In my mind, there are better things to give your money to. And I hold my college experience in high regard, even though I owe a lot of money still. And even though, you know, all this stuff, I think it was an important experience for me. But
hard to donate money to a school that you still owe money
to. It's
very
hard. That's,
you know.
It's hard.
Also, how do they accept that gift? They'd be like, well, we appreciate your $2,000 gift, but you still owe us $50,000.
Right.
Like, why don't you chip away at that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No, exactly. And I know that that has nothing to do with them. It's not like they loaned me the money.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Okay.
But still, yeah. Fundamentally, and I think this speaks to part of the divide that we were talking about before, not to go back to this, but to get that high level education and to ensure that you're in a place where you can be accepted to that high level education, there's a lot of money that typically goes into that.
Yeah.
From starting from a very young age, to put yourself in the proper circles, to be able to like have your median place that you can get accepted to be very good still.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Even from public schools, unless you're going to like the best public schools, you know, you have to be really top of the class to have a shot.
Dude, and it's only getting harder.
Right.
You know, it is so apparent to me as I, especially as I, you know, I tutored a lot of seventh and eighth graders, and I stopped tutoring, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, which means that all those kids now are either like freshmen in college or they were applying. And I had some really smart kids.
Right.
I mean, I had, these were wealthy, Upper East Side, top private schools in New York City. Yeah. Trinity, Dalton. Collegiate, Dalton, Horace Mann,
right.
Fieldston, all these schools that are held up as like the best private schools in the country.
Right.
And these kids are, you know, yeah, some of them are getting into like Georgetown, which is sensational.
Totally.
But the kids who are getting into Georgetown are being summarily rejected by the Ivy League schools.
Interesting.
Across the board, every single one.
Wow.
And they, you know, they've got fucking near perfect SAT scores.
Right.
They've got 3.8 GPAs. They're involved in every single club.
You could imagine,
everything.
Right.
They've been groomed.
And their entire family's been going to them for generations.
Correct.
And they still can't get in.
And it's just not happening. And on top of that, the cost of a year in college at these elite private school colleges has gone up to $75,000 a year.
Wow.
And you start to wonder, are we pricing ourselves out of college? At what point will that elite private college education no longer be worth it?
Right.
How is the model shifting? By the time we have kids who are ready for college, will them coming to us and saying, I don't want to go to college, will we be relieved to hear that?
Right.
Will we be like, yeah, I agree. It's a fucking bad idea at this point.
Totally. Interesting.
Food for thought.
Chris, what's up?
Do you think that this whole Corona stuff will have a huge impact on it too? Because a lot of kids are taking a year off school. They don't want to pay these absurd amount of money to go to school online.
It's a great question. I
think the answer is no, ultimately.
You don't think it's going to impact it?
No. I think that once, if things resume as normal, like those people are going to want to still go to these schools.
Yeah. I think it has an impact in the near term. I think that for this year and then this next year, a lot of kids will end up taking a year off to go do internships or fucking maybe travel. I doubt it. But I have a student that I was, you know, very close to that I kept in touch with who went to USC, and this is crazy. He was studying abroad in Rome, in Italy, and was supposed to be there the whole semester,
right?
The spring semester. All this shit starts happening. Italy was, as you remember, the hot zone in the world. And they sent all their students who were studying abroad there home. He had to go to a hotel near USC and quarantine in isolation in his hotel room for 2 weeks.
Ooh.
They would drop his food off at his door. He was going fucking crazy. And finally, eventually, you know, USC obviously shut down their campus. He comes back to New York City, finishes his semester online. And as an out-of-state student at USC, it's probably like $40,000 a year or something. He said, not fucking worth it. How can you justify burdening yourself with student debt when you don't have access to things like your fraternity, your social life, going to the classes in person. It sounds like the professors did everything they could, but for the most part, everyone was mailing it in,
totally.
Staff and students alike.
Totally.
And so USC is saying the online classes shit's going to continue in the fall, and he has already made up his mind it's not fucking worth it.
Totally. And especially we've been getting emails from people too about people who are starting business school who are like connections are like the main part of going to business school. So why would I go when exactly. I can't physically go? And that's a strong argument, but it's interesting to see these businesses make uncompelling arguments about how like every business that I know is like, we're open, come, because they have to, because otherwise they're going to fail.
Right.
And I maybe not as much for the schools because the schools have endowments and all this stuff, whatever. But like hotels are like, come stay with us. And you're like, that's such a bad idea.
Right.
It seems.
I totally agree.
It's crazy.
Let's wrap it there for today. This has been a very, I don't know, a lot of like a very heavy episode of Oops the Podcast. But we felt that it necessary to speak on these issues. Join us again on Thursday. We're going to have Esther Pavitsky on the podcast. And she's fantastic comedian. She's got a great special coming out. And then also join us on Friday, of course, for the second half of this discussion, which we're recording today. As always, please send your stories, thoughts from quarantine. We love hearing from you guys. And we will always share and touch upon issues that we think or submissions that we think are compelling. I'm Francis Ellis. He's Giulio Gallerati. You guys are the best. Thank you so much.
From the studio. Thank you guys for tuning in.
Hell yeah.